Tamam, şimdi sadece testi göstermekle eğitim noktalarında sanırım önemli. Ama Spaces var dedi ve demek ki sanırım ve Spaces'a sanırım ve Spaces'a sanırım. Onu yönetimimin özel, dönemden o sırada çok şey içinde tanıdığını tartışma sevgilerini var. Suicide tanıdığını bizden tutupi tanıdığını bildiler. Sen yıkılamaya yıldırdı zaten. Yesterday, we heard about Lord Balaram. I'd like to ask, does anyone remember anything from yesterday's class? It wasn't about this, but I'll ask it anyway. Does anyone remember anything about Lord Balaram? It was quite amazing.
Yeah.
I'm still amazed by it.
But I love that story.
Because Balaram never told me what he told her.
He's very nice.
In one sentence, sum up our position in relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
You were establishing the Supreme Position of Godhead.
And the unsupreme position of me.
Yes.
But I'm working on it. And the day before, that's really testing things.
Well, we still were hearing about Krishna and we went to visit his family.
Yeah, and you just offered prayers and asked him if he could perform.
He explained that he wanted that all the most important people in the world would come because it's such a prestigious function. And then, at the beginning of the function, he would ask them all who should be worshipped first, because that's the most prestigious of all prestigious people, and they would of course want to worship Krishna, and then that would establish him for the benefit of everybody who couldn't understand his position. He established him. He just didn't have any interest in the wealth or prestige that might accompany such a big event.
So that would be one of the functions that would establish Krishna and also establish that the success that Yudhisthira is achieving as the emperor is due to the fact that he is devotee of Krishna. So Yudhisthira Maharaj has finished his prayers. So intimate his relationship with Krishna is that Krishna is living in his, he's come to visit him in his palace and acts sometimes as the servant of the Pandavas. Now Krishna is going to respond. Sri Bhagavan Vacha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, said, "Your decision is perfect, O King. And thus your noble fame will spread to all the worlds, O tormentor of your enemies." So he, Krishna, is saying that the decision is perfect because Yudhisthira is going to become very famous. So it's so interesting, the reciprocal affectionate dealings between Krishna and his devotees, is that the devotee, Yudhisthira, wanted Krishna to be famous and Krishna wants the devotee to be famous. And the devotee is not interested in his own fame, but it follows him. And Krishna is not interested in his own fame, but what can he do? He's all attractive. What to do? Your decision is perfect, O King, and thus your noble fame will spread to all the worlds, O tormentor of your enemies. Purport. Lord Krishna here concurs with King Yudhisthira's decision that the Rajasuya sacrifice should be performed. The Lord further agrees that there is nothing unfair in the fact that one result is achieved by those who worship him and another by those who do not. That was a point that came out in the verse. The verses. The great Bhagavatam commentators point out that by addressing King Yudhisthira as Shatru Karshana, tormentor of enemies, Lord Krishna is imparting to him the potency to conquer all the enemy kings. Because to be perform the Rajasuya sacrifice, again, that enthrones one as the emperor. And the emperor is different from a king because he's the topmost king. Thus Krishna predicted, so just by Krishna calling him defeater or tormentor of your enemies, he's imparting to him the potency to actually be the emperor. Because no one can have any powerful position without the grace of God. And when there are pious persons who have a powerful position, they immediately acknowledge that. And there are impious people who have some material piety but no spiritual piety, and that allows them to have the position. But they're always, because they're thinking it's up to them to maintain it, so they're always what?
Anxiety.
Complete anxiety, and always extremely fearful. And when I think of this principle, I think of one of the great demons of the 20th century. Is anyone good at mind reading and knows mm-hmm. what I'm thinking of? Oh, you already know all my stories. Yeah, Mao Zedong, who is the father of they don't worship God in China, and they don't even like Mao Zedong. Actually, they know he's such a he was terrible. He killed millions and millions and millions and millions, at least 10 million people minimum. So China is relatively modern now, but what a price! And people are always afraid too. So in any case, he gained power very courageously, and he felt himself a great hero, and indeed on a certain level he was. But to gain power is one thing, and to maintain it is another. And the example of Bali Maharaj, as soon as Bali Maharaj became the king, he wasn't actually pious enough to be the king of heaven because he was an asura, and Indra had a different kind of piety. But due to the faults that Indra made, Bali Maharaj became the king of heaven. But he understood that his piety wasn't enough to maintain his position as the king. So he began to perform sacrifices under the direction of his spiritual master, whose name was?
Sukracharya.
And his other name is? Sukracharya's other name is? Mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. So he immediately began to perform very pious activities to boost up his piety so he can maintain the position. But Mao Zedong, instead of doing that, because he didn't have that spiritual piety, he became frightened. And as he got older, and as he consolidated power, he became more and more frightened. And he became so afraid of everyone. And he became completely paranoid at the end. And the closer someone was to him, the more he feared him. Because when you have power, you don't trust anyone. You're always thinking there's some plot. And he ended up killing so many of his closest, the people who got close to him. And it was like, you know, you're elevated to a position close to the ruler, and it was like almost like a death sentence. And in his inimitable style, in the style of the worst part of China, when he would kill people, he would do it in such a way. He would, not all the time, but sometimes he would chop them up and feed them to their family members.
Krishna.
You go crazy. If you don't have the piety, you go crazy. Piety means you're invested with power. So what Prabhupada said, he said that no ordinary person, devotee even, can become the king of the world. You like that story, huh?
I think so.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, this is... Yeah, China's a very exciting place. Yeah, that's an old Chinese trick. They didn't invent it. But in any case, Prabhupada said that to become the king of the world, you have to be not an ordinary devotee even. He said ordinary devotee. He said you have to be a Mahabhagavat. That means so pure that Krishna will empower you to take that position. So Yudhisthira was a Mahabhagavat. And Lord Krishna is imparting to him the potency to conquer all the enemy kings. So no one should be proud of whatever their potency or abilities they have, because it is coming from Krishna, rather, should be used in Krishna's service. Thus Krishna predicted that King Yudhisthira's noble fame would spread to all the worlds, and in fact it has. Indeed, my lord, he called Yudhisthira my lord, because he was acting very respectfully. For the great sages, the forefathers, and the demigods, for our well-wishing friends, and indeed for all living beings, the performance of this king of Vedic sacrifices is desirable. First, conquer all kings, bring the earth under your control, and collect all the required paraphernalia, then execute this great sacrifice. These brothers of yours, O king, have taken birth as partial expansions of the demigods, ruling various planets, and you are so self-controlled that you have conquered even me, who am unconquerable for those who cannot control their senses. See, the Prabhupada writes in Krishna. Okay, what was the essence of that verse?
Conquering oneself.
I'll read it one more time though. These brothers of yours, O king, have taken birth as partial expansions of the demigods, ruling various planets. And you are so self-controlled, explaining the piety of these persons, of his brothers and himself. You are so self-controlled, because if not one is self-controlled, pious, one cannot be self-controlled, because an uncontrolled mind and uncontrolled senses is due to which mode of material nature? I'll give you a hint. It's not goodness. It's combinations of the other two. So Raja and Tama, passion, ignorance, are impious modes of material nature. In other words, because of impious activities, sinful activities, the mind is filled with so many desires. So piety means the mode of goodness, even on the material level. And that allows one to be self-controlled. And also born of the mode of goodness is sattvam, sanjayate jnanam, and also happiness and peacefulness. But you are so self-controlled, Yudhisthira, that you have conquered even me, who am unconquerable for those who cannot control their senses. So there's a little bit of preaching in there, isn't there? Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna, it is said that Bhim was born of the demigod, which one? Vayu. And Arjuna was born of the demigod, whereas King Yudhisthira himself was born of the demigod. Have you been reading ahead? That's pretty good. So the Prabhupada goes on to state, which also explains interestingly why he was, who always in the court who protected him always. There were two people who protected the Pandavas.
Bhishma
and Vidura. And Vidura was?
Kimraj.
And Yudhisthira was?
Shanu.
Just see. King Yudhisthira himself was born of the demigod Yamaraj. Srila Prabhupada goes on to state, Lord Krishna told King Yudhisthira that he becomes conquered by the love for one of one who has conquered his senses. One who has not conquered his senses cannot conquer the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is the secret of devotional service. To conquer the senses means to engage them constantly in the service of the Lord. The specific qualification, this is still Prabhupada's quotation from Prabhupada's Krishna book. The specific qualification of all the Pandavas' brothers was that they always engaged their senses in the service of the Lord. One who thus engages his senses becomes purified, and with purified senses, one can actually render service to the Lord. The Lord can thus be conquered by the devotee through loving transcendental service, using all of one's senses, and including the mind. This has a tendency to engage our senses even in Krishna service and allow our mind to go wild. It's that tendency. So the mind should be engaged very, very carefully also in serving Krishna. So how should one engage, how can one engage one's mind? Chanting.
Breathing.
Yeah.
Doing service. Vocation of the time.
Okay. How is the service performed? With the mind or
it
the...
It could be also if it's material service, but you can do it for Krishna. So it's,
but therein lies the key. That you have to keep Krishna in your mind then. If you're going to do it for Krishna, you can do it for Krishna and not engage your mind. I mean, I know all about that. But then it's not exactly the same as doing it for Krishna and thinking, oh Krishna, may you be pleased by that, which is the conclusion in one sense of the Karma Kandya section of the Vedas, that you do your work, or you can say Karma Yoga, you do your work, and this is described in the Bhagavad Gita, yatta pravata bhutanam yena savamigantatam, but you're doing it thinking, may Krishna be pleased by this. And Prabhupada also describes this in his purport, the verse in the 18th chapter, beginning, chaitasya savakamani, we should think that Krishna has engaged me in this service, and let me do it in such a way, this work, and let me do it in such a way that Krishna will be pleased. So if we're thinking like that, how can I do this so Krishna will be pleased? And you know, doing it carefully and nicely for Krishna's pleasure, then we're engaging our mind also. Chanting, hearing, remembering also. So it's easier to engage the senses, the working senses, and knowledge acquiring senses, than to engage the mind. But also planning. Oh, how can I do this in such a way that Krishna will be pleased? Same point. But I should try to make sure Krishna's in there somehow or another.
Thinking how to please his devotees.
Yeah. That's one thing that Prabhupada really did. He made such a huge society with such that could take any amount of people, engage any amount of people in Krishna service, using any amount of things too, seeing the world not in a way of true renunciation, seeing the world as Krishna's, and therefore using it in Abhanda, Krishna Sambandha, in his service. How could this, which is Krishna's, be used in Krishna's service, And Prabhupada was really like that. He had such huge vision and wishing to see everything used in Krishna service. One time, probably in 1966, maybe 66, when they used to have kirtans in 22nd Avenue, and there was one fellow who used to come and play the inside of a piano, just bang away on the inside of a piano. You ever see the inside of a piano? You ever seen? It's like a harp. It's just, so he had one of the always used to carry one with him and he'd bang on it. So somehow or another, this fellow, the biggest, most famous music hall in New York City, practically, well, not the biggest, but it's old and traditional, it's Carnegie Hall. Very famous. So he rented it. And he was going to have a program, and he'd come out, and he had a piano. Mm-hmm. Huh?
Piano man rented it.
Yeah. You didn't know the story? So the piano man rented Carnegie Hall, and there's a piano there. He opened it up and started banging on the things in his own unique style.
It was popular.
Oh, very popular. Millions of people came from all over the... where were they coming in? Australia. They came from far and wide, from Whiteman Park, especially. So anyway, because he invited Prabhupada to come to his recital. And you know who came? Prabhupada. Prabhupada went. And during the intermission, halftime, in the middle, after he came and he went over to Prabhupada and said, "How do you like it?" And everything went very good. And then, but he didn't stay for the second half. And then some appointments that I have to go to a little late. So in any case, the devotees asked Prabhupada, or somehow it came out, and they went by subway too. Prabhupada was traveling by the subway in New York. It's always a unique experience. And the devotees said to Prabhupada, "Cause have you ever been on the New York subway? Have you ever been on the New York subway? Have you ever been in New York subway?" "Yes." "I can't believe it." "You've never? Minimum of 80% of your life has been wasted." "You haven't?"
"Delhi subway?"
"No. Delhi subway is new and clean." "Have you ever been on the Delhi subway?" "No, no one's even been on the Delhi subway. There's nothing to compare it to." Anyway, the devotee said, "This is just like hell, Prabhupada." And Prabhupada said, "No, in hell there's no electricity." "That's more like the Delhi subway." "There's no electricity." "No, sometimes it's..." "No, Delhi subway is quite nice for here." But in any case, the devotees asked Prabhupada, somehow it came out when they were talking to him, why he decided to go. And he said, "I was thinking of getting it for a temple, Carnegie Hall." Prabhupada thought this. So empowered. So that's how to engage the senses and engage the mind. Be always thinking of how to please Guru, Vaishnava, Krishna, Mahaprabhu, Nityananda Prabhu, etc. So that takes some knowledge. You have to know the persons involved to know how, what will please them. Prabhupada also used to give the example at 22nd Avenue. He would tell the devotees, "If I ask you for some water, and you think, oh, milk is so much better than water, so I'll bring him milk. And Prabhupada says, that is not the mood of service when we ask for water. So you have to know and you have to listen. So Krishna continued, no one in this world, even a demigod, what to speak of an earthly king, can defeat my devotee with his strength, beauty, fame, or riches. That's what Krishna said. Then Sukadeva Goswami said, upon hearing these words sung by the Supreme Lord, these are nice, nice verses too. Upon hearing these words sung by the Supreme Lord, King Yudhisthira became
happy.
Happy? What else?
Enlightened.
Yeah, it's getting there. Came joyful. Nishamya Bhagavad Gita, that was the Bhagavad Gita, the words of Bhagavan. Prita Fula Mukambuja Bratrandig Vijaye Yungta Vishnu Tejo Pabrinhitam. Sukadeva Goswami said, upon hearing these words sung by the Supreme Lord, King Yudhisthira became joyful, and his face blossomed like a flower, like a lotus flower, indeed. Thus he sent forth his brothers, who were empowered with Lord Vishnu's potency to conquer all directions. How many brothers?
Four.
How many directions?
Four.
North, south, east, west. He sent Sahadev to the south with the Srinjayas, Nakul to the west with the Matsyas, these were the army, the armies. Arjun to the north with the Kekayas, and Bhim to the east with the Madrakas. I think because it must have been the southerners, because one of Krishna's, no, that's not the Madra, because one of Krishna's wives was from the Madras, it would seem, from the south. I think it was not Lakshmana, but Bhadra, I think. Bhadra or Lakshmana. After defeating many kings with their prowess, these heroic brothers brought back abundant wealth for Yudhisthira Maharaj, who was intent on performing the sacrifice of king. Who's the old king? Means Maharaj Prickett, because Sukadeva is speaking this to Maharaj Prickett, and Maharaj Prickett is hearing about his forefather, Maharaj Yudhisthira, and his uncles and father. Well, yeah, this is actually grandfather's. Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna book, it may be noted that by dispatching his younger brothers to conquer in different directions, King Yudhisthira did not actually intend that they declare war with the kings. Actually, the brothers started for different directions to inform the respective kings about King Yudhisthira's intention to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. The kings were thus informed that they were required to pay taxes for the execution of the sacrifice. This payment of taxes to Emperor Yudhisthira meant that the king accepted subjugation before him. In case of a king's refusal to act accordingly, then there was certainly a fight. Thus, by their influence and strength, the brothers conquered all the kings in different directions, and they were able to bring in sufficient taxes and presentations. These were brought before King Yudhisthira by his brothers. When King Yudhisthira heard that Jarasandha remained undefeated, he was in which direction? In the east. The other one.
East.
Yes. Because Bihar, Magda, they were in around Delhi. So he set to pondering. He began to think when he heard that Jarasandha remained undefeated. He wouldn't submit. And then, so it was all going according to Krishna's plan. Two things, that was what Uddhava said, you're going to have to, the two things are actually one thing. They're not in opposition to each other, because to perform the Rajasiya sacrifice, you have to conquer or kill practically Jarasandha anyway. He's not going to surrender. So then the primeval lord, Hari, told him the means Uddhava had described for defeating Jarasandha. Thus Bhima saying, this was the means, Arjuna and Krishna disguised themselves as Brahmins. And they went to Giri Vraja, which has nothing to do with Giri Raja. They went to Giri Vraja, my dear king, where the son of Bhadrana, a Brihadratta, was to be found, Jarasandha, disguised as Brahmanas. The royal warriors approached Jarasandha at home during the appointed hour for receiving guests, because the king would receive visitors and he would open the door at certain times every day, and anyone who had a complaint or a need or something, they could submit that before the king. They had direct representation, the ability to do that. Even it's in historical written records, not only Shastra, there was one old, there was a king in India in the last 1,000 years, or maybe, or within 2,000 years at least, for sure, that he had a golden rope tied to some place in the center of town, or a bell or something like that, a golden rope that was attached to a bell inside the king's court, and that if anyone had a complaint, they could come and ring the bell, and then they would be allowed to go in. Can you imagine if anyone had a complaint nowadays?
Let's think of a golden rope.
Well, the golden rope would last about 5 minutes.
Yes.
My complaint is I don't have this golden rope. People were more respectful in those days than they did. And I guess they were satisfied because they weren't so advanced as the people nowadays. Well, they felt completely miserable that, I mean, no one has any respect for the government. In no country does anyone have respect for the government, practically speaking. In India, they at least once a year or twice a year, they always show in Parliament, that the Indian Parliament, Australian Parliament is also wild. They criticize each other and make noises at each other and boo each other and things like that. How can the common people be respectful? But India is they physically fight all the time. And what they especially like to do is they hit each other with like the microphone, like the speakers have a microphone and they hit each other with the microphone. And the worst insult that you can do, they do sometimes. Last year they did it one time, is that the opposition party or something, or they took off their shoes and they were beating the other party with their shoes, which in India is. But they wouldn't do that to the speaker, the main speaker in Parliament. Well, what do the common people think if the leaders are acting in this way? How wild does the parliament in Israel get?
Not that wild.
But it gets wild?
Yes.
The United States isn't even as wild as maybe it is now. But Australia, they criticize each other so much. It's very distasteful. Huh?
They say some awful things to each other.
Yeah, they swear also.
Yeah.
Well, that's because they're all drunk. Because the bar is right there. They have a tavern inside. A bar, pub, as they call it here. Yeah. And you told me that one of the parliament people...
Some general, somebody who got into a position of responsibility wanted to close the bar.
Yeah. Okay.
In parliament hours. And that was the big
they rocked. I mean, it's incredible that they can't. They just teased him and mocked him, right?
Mm.
And what was he trying to do? Stop them from being intoxicated while they're running the country. Something so foolish as that. I mean, you would think you'd want a sober. I mean, would you?
I mean, they even have, if you're driving a car, you're not allowed to drink. What to speak of driving the country? Yes.
In Morocco, I saw some on television. My mother's house, there was something, and they were arguing backs and forwards, and they were finding all sorts of horrible things to say to each other, and call each other names. You just looked at that and you thought, those are people who are making serious decisions of this country about war and peace and health and all that.
And raising of salaries of theirs. So it was so much easier when there was a king, because you know they called the opposition in Australia recently, they were criticizing the current prime minister as incompetent. They were calling him incompetent, which is so insulting. So if there was a king, he just would have killed him. Problem solved. I mean, but he had to be a good king, because there's lots of bad kings who do stuff like that too.
He may be incompetent in some one of them.
Huh?
He may be incompetent in some one of them.
Right. But what are the common people supposed to think? It's not that your prestige gets raised when you call them incompetent, because what do? They call you incompetent. And what happens is the people lose all respect for all government. It's a fact known, and it's very psychologically, what to speak of governmentally, but psychologically unhealthy. Because naturally the king is supposed to be loved, the ruler is supposed to be loved and respected by the citizen, and he's even called Naradeva. He's supposed to act as a way that represents the Supreme Lord, just as the parents and teachers do. And when these positions are not held in esteem because of the being misused, then it becomes very hard for the people to have the proper psychology to surrender to God, even because they can't trust authority. And the parents, the teachers, the priests, and the government leaders prove themselves corrupt. Makes it so much harder to trust any authority. These are the material authorities, so it's sort of like software bugs when this doesn't work. And then when you can't trust the Supreme either, the Supreme Lord, because you have no experience of authority being good. It's very difficult to overcome this type of conditioning. Only by Krishna's grace and the grace of the Holy Name. So, Jarasandha was there, and he was very, very expert Kshatriya, and he followed Kshatriya Dharma. He had one fault only, and that was that he was a demon. But aside from that, he was really pious and a gentleman, but he was averse to Krishna. So Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima, I will read Prabhupada's purport. King Jarasandha was a very dutiful householder, and he had great respect for the Brahmins. He was a great fighter, a Kshatriya king, but he was never neglectful of the Vedic injunctions. According to Vedic injunctions, the Brahmins are considered to be the spiritual master of all the other castes. Lord Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhimasena were actually Kshatriyas, but they dressed themselves as Brahmins. And at the time, when King Jarasandha was to give charity to the Brahmins and receive them as guests, they approached him. Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima said, "O King, know us to be needy guests who have come to you from afar. We wish all good to you. Please grant us whatever we desire. What can the tolerant not bear? What will the wicked not do? What will the generous not give in charity? And who will those of equal vision see as an outsider?" So, this is what they said to him. What can the tolerant not bear? What will the wicked not do? What will the generous not give in charity? And who will those of equal vision see as an outsider? I spoke very sweetly. In the previous verse, purport, Lord Krishna and the two Pandava brothers. Which brothers? Bhima and Arjuna. They were so powerful looking, dressed as Brahmins and begging. They requested Jarasandha to grant them whatever they asked of him. Here they explain why there is no need for them to specify their desires, because they didn't say what they wanted in the beginning. Because you would usually, when you ask for something, you say, I want this and I want that. I want this particular thing and that particular thing. But they didn't do that. Rather, they said, "What you're such a generous person." They were leading him with that line. So what is there that you won't give us? Because if they told him what he wanted, then they would, if he gave to the Brahmanas in charity. So it would have been awkward. So also earlier in the chapter, when Uddhava advised them what to do, several chapters ago rather, he explained why this was the tactic. Because if they attacked with the soldiers, Jarasandha's armies plus Jarasandha were practically undefeatable, and so many people would have been killed. So they thought to fight Jarasandha, because his armies were so great, individually there would be a greater chance of victory without much bloodshed. They only wanted to kill Jarasandha. They didn't want to kill everyone else.
Was it Jarasandha that got defeated by Krishna 17 times?
Yeah. This was Uddhava's advice. Jarasandha with his armies would be unconquerable, even though Krishna had defeated him and his armies before. The Acharya's comment on this verse is followed. Jarasandha might be thinking, what if you request my son, from whom separation would be intolerable? To this possible objection, Krishna the Pandavas reply, for a tolerant person, nothing is intolerable. Similarly, Jarasandha could object, what if you ask me to give my body? Because that's been known to be done, Dadichi Muni. Or my precious jewels or other ornaments which are meant to be given to my sons, not to ordinary beggars. To this they reply, for the generous, what is not to be donated in charity? In other words, everything is to be given. Jarasandha might also object that he could be giving charity to his enemies. To this, his guests counter with the statement, Kapara Samadarshana. Who is your enemy? For those with equal vision, who are Samadarshan, who are advanced, who is to be considered a stranger, an outsider? Thus, Sri Krishna and the Pandavas encouraged Jarasandha to simply agree to grant their request without further discussion. They continue. He is indeed to be censored and pitied who, though able to do so, fails to achieve with his temporary body the lasting fame glorified by great saints. Harishchandra, Rantidev, Unchavritti, Mungala, Sibi, Bali, and the legendary hunter and pigeon, and many others have attained the permanent by means of the impermanent. So Harishchandra, there's a long story, I think it comes from the Mahabharata, about Harishchandra, incredible suffering that he underwent, and he remained very fixed in his vow. Rantidev was starving and he gave away his food. Unchavritti, I don't know him. And Mugdal, I don't know. Sibi gave away his flesh. Bali Maharaj gave everything, his kingdom, and the hunter and the pigeon. He gave away his flesh also. He was ready to do that to protect the pigeon, the king was. And many others attained the permanent by means of the impermanent. They were ready to sacrifice their own bodies to gain something of permanent value. And what was the permanent that they gained? Reputation. So their bodies die and they move on, but their reputation lives still to today, even though their activities went on thousands of years before. There'll be some explanation of who all these individuals are. Here Lord Krishna, the two Pandavas,
pointing out to Dharasandha that one can use the temporary material body to achieve a permanent situation in life. Because Dharasandha was a materialist, they appealed to his natural instinct, interest in the heavenly planets, where life lasts so long that it appears permanent.
People on earth.
Srila Sridhar Swami briefly summarizes the history of the personalities mentioned in this verse. To pay off his debts to Vishwamitra, Harishchandra sold everything he had, including his wife and children. Yet even after attaining the status of a chandal, he did not become discouraged. Thus he went to heaven together with all the inhabitants of Ayodhya. Ranti Dev, after going without even water for 48 days, somehow obtained some food and water. But then some beggars came and he gave it all away to them. In this way he attained Brahmaloka. Mudgal followed the practice of gathering grains left behind in the fields after the harvest, yet he was hospitable towards uninvited guests even after his family had been suffering in poverty for 6 months. Thus he also went to Brahmaloka. To protect a pigeon who had taken shelter of him, Maharaj Sibi gave his own flesh to a hawk and attained heaven. Bali Maharaj gave all his property to Lord Hari when the Lord disguised himself as a dwarf Brahmana, Ramanadev, and so Bali gained the Lord's personal association. The pigeon and his mate gave their own flesh to a hunter as a show of hospitality, and thus they were taken to heaven in a celestial aeroplane. When the hunter understood their situation in the mode of goodness, he also became renounced, and thus he gave up hunting and went off to perform severe austerities. Because he was freed from all sins, after his body burned to death in a forest fire, he was elevated to heaven. Thus many personalities have attained enduring life on higher planets by means of the temporary material body. Sukadeva Goswami said, now they've presented their case to Dharasandha, and Sukadeva begins to speak. From the sound of their voices, Dharasandha was intelligent. From their physical stature, and from the marks of bowstrings on their forearms. How do you get marks of bowstrings on your forearms?
You have to carry for them.
Forearms means where?
No, after you then.
Yeah. Oh, if you're not careful, if you ever shoot a bow and arrow, you always end up hurting yourself. Therefore, they often wear some protection over there.
Mm.
So there were some marks. So for someone like Arjuna, who used to practice continuously, he must have been heavily calloused there. So he could tell, Dharasandha could tell his guests were Kshatriyas of the royal Rajanya Bandhu Vigyaya. He knew that they were of the royal order. He began to think that he had seen them somewhere before. The Acharyas point out purport that Dharasandha had seen Lord Krishna, Bhima and Arjuna at Draupadi's Swayamvara ceremony. Since they had come begging in the guise of Brahmins, Dharasandha thought they must be low class Kshatriyas, as indicated here by the word Rajanya Bandhu. Because they are begging. Kshatriyas do not beg. They don't beg anyone for anything. It's against their mentality. Because they can't be Kshatriyas and be that humble. They have to be ready to meet every challenge and fight. Someone insults them, they have to fight. Someone challenges them, they have to fight. They have to be able to protect a citizen. If the citizen is in danger, they have to be fearless. They need a particular ego, sense of self, abhiman. Dharasandha thought, these are surely members of the royal order, dressed as Brahmins. But still I must grant their request for charity, even if they beg me for my own body. He was so committed to giving charity. Also Karna was a great giver of charity. And even Duryodhana, when it was Yudhisthira, who was it? Yudhisthira came to him, or Arjuna came to him?
The five arrows.
The five arrows. Was it Arjuna? Arjuna, I think. Huh? He owed him a favor, and he said, "You remember that Arjuna came to this was just while the battle of Kurukshetra was going on." He said, "You remember you? I had asked you. You know, you had said you would give me whatever I want."
Duryodhana, this is all the battles going, said, yes, I'll give you whatever you want. Even if you ask for the kingdom now, if you're going to beg that for me, I'll give it to you. Such a sense of
pride.
And he said, no, I don't want that. Well, what do you want? I want those 5 arrows. And the Duryodhana, he understood that Krishna was behind this. Because you know the story of those 5 arrows? They were sanctified. Because Duryodhana was always accusing Bhishma, because he knew that Bhishma was partial to the Pandavas, of not fighting to his full ability. He was the general against the Kuru army, against the Pandavas. And Duryodhana was always pushing him, saying that he's partial and not fighting and not killing the Pandavas. So he got Bhishma so angry that he said, tomorrow I'm going to kill each and every one of those Pandavas, and I have 5 sanctified arrows that will do it. So Duryodhana was so happy that his plan worked, that he got he tweaked Bhishma's false ego enough to get him angry enough to do this. And he said, good, and I'll take those arrows on. I'll keep them. I'll keep them during the night so nothing happens to them. Then Arjuna came and then begged for the 5 arrows, and he thought, he knew that Krishna, tricky Krishna, is behind this one.
I mean, it's not the first time that he's been tricked by Krishna.
What other time was he tricked by Krishna?
When actually his mother asked him to come naked.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when Krishna saw him and says, how come you're going naked in front of your mother?
How
come
you know? So then at least put on a gumshoe. I mean, after all. He's so tricky, this Krishna. She was going to take off her blindfold and look at him because by the power of her chastity, it was so powerful, she was going to make him practically invulnerable. So Jarasandha continued, I must grant their request for charity, even if they beg me for my own body. Indeed, the spotless glories of Bali Maharaj are heard throughout the world. Lord Vishnu, wishing to recover Indra's opulence from Bali, appeared before him in the guise of a Brahmana and made him fall from his powerful position. Though aware of the ruse and forbidden by his guru, Bali, king of the demons, still gave Vishnu the whole earth in charity. What is the use of an unqualified Kshatriya who goes on living but fails to gain everlasting glory by working with his perishable body for the benefit of Brahmins? Sukadev Goswami continued, thus making up his mind, the generous Jarasandha addressed Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima. All learned Brahmanas, he knew they weren't Brahmanas, choose whatever you wish, I will give it to you, even if it is my own head. The Supreme Lord said, O exalted King, give us battle in the form of a duel, if you think it's fitting. We are princes and have come to beg a fight. We have no other request to make of you. Over there is Bhim, the son of Prita, and this is his brother Arjun, and know me to be their maternal cousin, Krishna, your enemy. Thus challenged, Magadha Raj, he laughed out loud and contemptuously said, all right, you fools, I'll give you a fight. Srila Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur comments that Jarasandha felt inner satisfaction because he thought that his enemies had been humiliated by having to dress like Brahmins to approach him. Thus the Acharya understands Jarasandha's mind as follows. O weak ones, forget your botheration of fighting. Why not just accept my head? By dressing yourselves as brahmanas, begging charity, you have made your heroism set like the sun. But if somehow you have not lost your courage, I will give you battle.
the Acharya finally points out that the goddess of learning intends the phrase Amarsito Mandaha to read Amarsito Amandaha. In other words, Lord Krishna and the Pandavas are Amanda, never foolish, and that is why they chose the best tactic for doing away once and for all with cruel Charasandha. So Charasandha continued, but I will not fight with you, Krishna, for you are a coward boy. You're a coward boy. You're a coward. You ran from the battle. You forgot that Krishna had defeated him 17 times before that. Your strength abandoned you in the midst of a battle, and you fled your own capital of Mathura to take shelter of the sea. Coward, I won't fight with you. As for this one, Arjuna, he is not as old as I, nor is he very strong. Since he's no match for me, he should not be the contender. Beam, however, is as strong as I. Having said this, Charasandha offered Bhimasena a huge club, and he took up another himself, and they went outside the city. Nothing like a good adventure story to keep everyone awake, huh? What's going to happen next? The two heroes thus began battling each other on the level fighting grounds outside the city. Maddened with the fury of combat, they struck each other with their lightning bolt-like clubs. As they skillfully circled left and right, like actors dancing on a stage, the fight presented a magnificent spectacle. Both were fearless, both were steady in their anger, and both were eager to demonstrate their skills. When Jarasandha and Bhimasena's clubs loudly collided, the sound was like the impact of the big tusks of two fighting elephants, or the crash of a thunderbolt in a flashing electrical storm. They swung their clubs at each other with such speed and force that as the clubs struck their shoulders, their hips, their feet, their hands, their thighs and collarbones, the weapons were crushed and broken like branches of orchid trees with which two enraged elephants furiously attacked each other. Their clubs thus ruined, those great heroes amongst men angrily pummeled each other with their iron-hard fists. As they slapped each other, the sounds resembled the crash of elephants colliding or harsh thunderbolts, thunderclaps. As they thus fought, this contest between opponents of equal training, strength, and stamina reached no conclusion, and so they kept on fighting, O King, without any let up. Some acharyas include the following two verses in the text of this chapter, and Srila Prabhupada has also translated them in Krishna. Thus, O King, these are the two verses, they continued fighting for 27 days, and at the end of each day's fighting, they both lived at night as friends in Jarasandha's palace. Then on the 28th day, that's inconceivable, isn't it? What a spirit these warriors had. They just loved the fight. How could they have done that? They hated each other, but they didn't carry it somehow. This is a real warrior. Then on the 28th day, O King, Vikodara Bhim told his maternal cousin, Krishna, Madhava, can't defeat Jarasandha in battle. But Lord Krishna knew the secret of his enemy Jarasandha's birth and death, and also how he had been given life by the demoness Jara. Jara was her name, and Sandha means the joint or the combination or the conjunction. So he's the conjunction of two parts. So Krishna knew this. Considering all this, Lord Krishna imparted his special power to Bhima. He didn't only tell him, but he imparted power to Prabhupada. So the Prabhupada writes that Lord Krishna knew the mystery of the birth of Jarasandha. Jarasandha was born in two different parts from two different mothers. When his father saw that the baby was useless, he threw the two parts in the forest, where they were later found by a black-hearted witch named Jara. She managed to join the two parts of the baby from top to bottom, and knowing this, Lord Krishna therefore also knew how to kill him. So he imparted his power to him. That's interesting. Tejasa. Tejasa chintayadhari. Hari gave him his tejas, his, And thus, having determined how to kill the enemy, that Lord of infallible vision made a sign to Bhim by tearing in half a small branch of a tree. We usually say it's like a piece of grass or something. He just ripped that piece half. Here it says, Vitapam, a tree branch. Understanding the sign, Krishna didn't say anything, he just did it. He just told him what to do in an indirect, little bit of an indirect way, gave him a hint. Understanding the sign, Mighty Bhim, the best of fighters, seized his opponent by the feet and threw him on the ground. Bhima pressed down on one leg with his foot. This wasn't cricket. Wasn't allowed to do this. This is against the rules. Bhima pressed down on one leg with his foot while grabbing Jarasandha's other leg in his hands. And just as a great elephant might break the branch of a tree, Bhima tore Jarasandha apart from the anus upward. The king's subjects then saw him lying in two separate pieces, each with a single leg, thigh, hip, shoulder, arm, eye, eyebrow, and ear, and with a half a back and chest. With the death of the Lord of Magda, a great cry of lamentation arose while Krishna and Arjuna congratulated Bhima by embracing him. Krishna could have told them that on the first day also.
Why did he wait then?
Huh?
Why did he wait it so
much? Yeah. Would you have liked to have seen that? A fight like that?
A fight?
Not to be on it, fighting with him.
Just next to
you. Just watching from the stands. Mm. The immeasurable Supreme Personality of Godhead, the sustainer and benefactor of all living beings, he coronated Jarasandha's son, Sahadev, as the new ruler of the Magadhas. The Lord then freed all the kings Jarasandha had imprisoned. So the Prabhupada writes, although Jarasandha was killed, neither Krishna nor the two Pandava brothers made a claim to the throne. Their purpose in killing Jarasandha was to stop him from creating a disturbance against the proper discharge of world peace. A demon always creates disturbances, as well Prabhupada has written. Whereas a demigod always tries to keep peace in the world. The mission of Lord Krishna is to give protection to the righteous persons and to kill the demons who disturb a peaceful situation. Therefore, Lord Krishna immediately called for the son of Jarasandha, whose name was Sahadev, and with due ritualistic ceremonies he asked him to occupy the seat of his father and reign over the kingdom peacefully. Lord Krishna is the master of the whole cosmic creation and he wants everyone to live peacefully and execute Krishna consciousness. After installing Sahadev on the throne, he released all the kings and princes who had been imprisoned unnecessarily by Jarasandha. Thus, in the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 10th canto, 72nd chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Slaying of the Demon Jarasandha. Another reason, see, because Bhima acted against the rules by doing that. And until he came to the conclusion that he couldn't defeat him by his own power, he probably wouldn't have. He wouldn't have resorted to that. But then by that time he knew it was Krishna's desire that he wins and he couldn't do it himself. So
So he just followed Krishna's hints and did it. Because he was a Kshatriya, a Kshatriya spirit. And when he had seen Arjuna and Bhim at Draupadi's Swayamvar, they were dressed as Brahmins also. We'll finish this. Charasandha is now dead. Any questions or comments?
About controlling the senses. I was eating in the Gita yesterday and it was always so painful that because the senses are the grossest, they are the easiest to control. But if we say the mind engages the senses and the mind is very difficult to control, so how do we control the senses?
You don't have to have complete control over the mind to control the senses. That's the basic idea.
Control the senses separately from the mind?
No, you obviously have to control. You have to be convinced that it's required. But the mind is much more subtle and difficult to control. You can put all your effort in good association, you could put yourself in a place where there's no opportunity to go against the or gaze in the sense gratification that you want. There are gross ways to control the senses, but the mind is far more difficult to control. Try it tomorrow. You can make the vow that I shall not eat ice cream. and see if you can keep that vow. And at the same time make a vow, I shall not think of ice cream. Never think of ice cream.
Or monkeys. Or anything. Or just keep,
just chant the whole day long and not think of anything else. And any time I think of anything else, I'll chant. And we'll just see how difficult the mind is. It just rebels, it refuses to be controlled. But by strength of intelligence, by some determination, you can control the senses in a much easier fashion than to control the wild mind, the greatest of all enemies.
Isn't it temporary?
Too.
Like if I decide I want to eat ice cream, you know, isn't it some kind of external decision which I will break eventually?
But once you do that and the mind gradually accepts it, when the senses are giving up their thirst and desire for the objects of the senses, the mind gradually accepts it and it cools down on that particular thing. So it's just a way of working towards controlling the mind, not that you can control the senses and not deal with the mind. It's a way to approach the enemy, so to speak, in the way that the Bhagavad Gita is speaking about it. Because really you do have to control the mind. But there's a famous Chanakya story, how when Chandragupta Maurya, when he was going to attack I can't remember the dynasty, that illegitimately had the throne. And first thing they did is they attacked the capital city and they were soundly defeated. So then he was wandering around in the forest incognito, feeling quite discouraged. And he went to, and he looked in some village and he saw that there was a little boy and his mother or grandmother. And the little boy was eating, he had a bowl full of khichdi. And he took some from the center. And his mother or grandmother told him, don't be so foolish like Chandragupta that you go right for the center. Go for the outside where it's cooler. And then it's true, if you ever want to eat your khichdi, don't go for the center unless you're, if you're eating by with your fingers, because that's where it's really hot. But around the edges, it's cool. So you have to find a way to get to the center. And you go around when there's a war. It's a strategy. You go, you first take the easy areas. So comparatively, even though it's not easy to control the senses, it's easier to control the senses than the mind, but eventually you have to get to the center. And that's the mind. But that's an easier way to do it.
Was it also that Krishna, when he taught Dhammapada, he also fought with him for 28 days?
21 or 28?
He went into that tunnel.
Yeah.
And he was absent from the...
chapter 52.
And they were wondering where he was.
Was it
14
days?
It was 18 days.
Okay. There's a Krishna book up there in chapter 42. You can look and report back to us in 2 minutes. Go look.
I have to get my glasses.
Okay, so maybe someone else can look. That's it. No, here it is. It's right here. No, it's right here.
He was 20-something.
Okay. Days, both daytime and nighttime, without stopping. The difference. And how many days was this? 28?
Yeah.
That they would stop? Yes. Got a severe pounding. He was so sore after that time. He couldn't bear it. He was a bear. Okay. Did you want to?
Yeah, I was just wondering, in the case of Jarasandha, he was so dutiful to the Vedas, all the instruction and junctions of the Vedas and the Brahmins. But somehow or other he was still considered to be a demon. Is that because he was worshipping he was worshipping the Vedas and the Brahmins.
Ravana also did, mm-hmm. did that. And also others. Ravana, but being demonic or asura is going against the final conclusion of the Vedas, which means to serve Vishnu or Hari.
Mm-hmm. Is that because we're focused on the karma conversation?
Something like that. Trying to do it to get power. Use the Vedas, misuse the Vedas, Vedic knowledge to gain something on the material level. What it's ultimately meant to transport us beyond the material level.
Obviously, the Brahmanas he was associating with, they didn't know the conclusions of the Vedas.
Well, that's also what happened to King
Prachinibhaj.
Exactly his name. That boy is still up. How come he didn't go to sleep?
He went to sleep from 4 to 6.
Oh. He had a hard day driving today. He was driving all over the place. He created a traffic jam outside the back. Did you see that?
Yeah.
On Zem. He's very well organized. Tomorrow is Friday.